Okay, so I'll cut out all the introductory stuff and we could go straight to the issue. So again, the topic is things that future Rabbanim should know, shailas that come up relative to Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzahs. I was going to start with Sefer Torah, but maybe it makes more sense to start with Tefillin, since perhaps... it's more common that a Rav will be asked questions about tefillin. The most common question I think that someone will walk over to a Rav and ask regarding tefillin is about the ribua of the tefillin. Specifically, if his batim are not round, are not sharp in the corners. Rather, they got some sort of a bang or they're rounded off. So a lot of people want to know if that's halachically problematic. So usually the Rav will look at it like he's looking at an esrog and will say, no, it looks square to me or it doesn't look square to me. So the question really is, what is halachically considered to be square and what halachically is no longer considered to be square? There is a halacha that the batim have to be square. It's a halacha l'moish misinai. And the question is, what's the parameters of what is square and what's not square? So we'll take one topic at a time. There are two topics to address. One, like we said, is the corners. The other topic is when the batim, there are four batim in the shel resh, when the four batim start spreading apart. As far as the corners are concerned, people get very paranoid if they find that their bias, the corner, is not exactly square. So that's really not a concern at all, because we're looking at the bias overall. And when we're looking at the bias overall, there's no halacha that the corner has to be sharp. It has nothing to do with the sharpness of the corner. It's the overall bias, and whether or not the overall bias, the four compartments of the shel resh, the one compartment of the shel yad, is square or it's not square. So does that mean that somebody has to take a tool? There's a tool that's called a caliper. It could measure to the thousandth of a millimeter or a centimeter. Do you have to take a caliper to measure your batim to determine whether or not they're actually square? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva. He says absolutely not. There's no need to use any measuring instrument. It has to look square. If it looks square, that is square. That's the opinion of the Chazon Ish and most other contemporary poskim as well, that if it looks square, it's square. On the other hand, while that presents a great kula, perhaps, but many people can't necessarily recognize when something is square, when something is not square. Chazal tell us, "Kol amsa b'ribua, amsa v'treichumshi ba'alach sayna," which means that a square, if you have a square amma, so the diagonal of that will be 1.2. That's a mathematical equation. So if you do the math, you'll find that that is not precise. It's 2% off. So there are many poskim that understand from that as long as it's within 2%, that is still called halachically square, because you see Chazal consider that to be square. What's 2%? So a standard bias, if you take a look at what's called the shadel. Shadel is the plastic on the bias. Usually the shadel has a number on it. Usually it's 31, 32, 33, something like that. So what's that number, 31, 32, 33? So let's take a standard bias. Let's say it's 33. 33 means that it's 33 millimeters squared. 33 millimeters is not referring to the base of the tefillin. Every pair of tefillin has a base and it has a ketzitza. I actually have a pair of tefillin here that someone's supposed to pick up. So you'll see that the bias has the base. The base is called the tetura, and it has the tower coming up. The tower coming up is called the ktsitsa. So when you have a number here on this bias, it's a 32. Okay? So this 32 over here, that means that this ktsitsa is 32 millimeters squared. That's what that means. 2% of 32 millimeters is 0.64 of a millimeter. So if it's 6.5 tenths of a millimeter off, the ribua, then that's going to be more than 2%, and l'chayra, that would qualify as not miruba. So again, if somebody wants to know what's the parameters of square, the parameters of square are that as long as it's within two, as long as it's within 6.5 tenths of a millimeter, in terms of a differential between one way and the other, so that would still be considered square. Once it's more than that, once you get to like 7 tenths of a millimeter or more, you're getting into halachically gray territory. Some paiskim will still say that that's square because most people that look at it will feel that it's square. And others say that no, that's no longer considered to be square, and that's something that has to be repaired. As far as the corners are concerned, like we said before, there's a Batimacher in Eretz Yisrael who wrote a sefer on Hilchas Batim. It's probably 30 years ago already. It's called Zichron Elio. His name is Elio Gitman. And I heard from Elio Gitman, he told me that he once went to Rabbi Yashiv, and he showed him a bias where the corner wasn't exactly sharp. He asked him, is this bias still square? So Rabbi Yashiv said, yes. So he's a bit of a character. Out of his pocket, he took a hammer. Took the hammer, he knocked the corner of the bias. He showed it to Rabbi Yashiv, he said, is this bias square? Rabbi Yashiv looked at it, yes. Took the hammer a second time, knocked the same corner again, harder, showed it to Rabbi Yashiv. Rabbi Yashiv looked at it, he smiled, he said, no, it's not square. So the point of the story is that people sometimes get a little bang on the corner, or the corner is not so sharp. That's not an issue. It's only if somebody really drops their bias and it gets a real bang on the corner that causes significant damage, then already you're getting into an area where perhaps halachically that's no longer considered to be square. There's another way that batim could lose the ribua, which is very, very common, both on the shel yad and on the shel reish, and that's when a bias starts to warp. Okay, if you look at these batim, you'll see the bottom of the bias is perfectly straight. It's 100% straight, flat. It's totally flat. When the bias sits on the head, or it sits on the arm, and the person sweats. So some people sweat quite a bit. And if somebody sweats quite a bit, very often, since the bias is leather, that'll cause the bias to start to warp. A warping bias, by definition, will no longer be squared, because there are three parts of the bias that have to be square. There's the top part over here, the ketzitza. There's the square of the base, the titura. The reason you have these two cutouts on the side is so that you can see what area has to be square. So the titura has to be square, the ketzitza has to be square, and the batim are sewn together. You see here there's sewing on both sides of the bias. The bias is sewn together. The tefiris, the sewing, the stitching, also has to be square. So when somebody sweats, the titura, the bottom of the titura, will start to warp. And if it's going to start to warp, it's no longer going to be flat. If it's no longer going to be flat, by definition, that generally will cause a problem with the ribua. Now, it's not only caused by sweat, it's caused by any form of moisture. So, if somebody showers before davening, by chassidim, it's common they'll go to the mikveh before davening. By non-chassidim, it's common that they'll take a shower before davening. If somebody's hair is still wet, so that, you know, I mean, chassidim don't have too much hair usually, so it dries much quicker. But by non-chassidim, which you all seem to be, so if somebody still has his hair and he takes a shower before davening and he puts on his tefillin while his hair is still wet, that very often will cause the underside of the batim to warp, and that can also cause a problem with the ribua. So it's very important for a person to be conscious of the fact that before davening his hair should be totally dry. So again, these are things that very often someone will come up to a Rav and show it to him. And it's important to know, like we said, what the parameters of square are and are not. So that's some outlines. There's another part of the bias that's called the Ma'abarta. The Ma'abarta is the tunnel that the Ritzua runs through. Now the Ma'abarta technically is not part of the bias. And everything that we just discussed references, like we said, the Titura, the Ketzitza, and the Tefiris. By the way, it's not so uncommon for the tefillos not to be perfectly square, but that's much harder for someone to notice. But an expert can tell sometimes that the tefillos are not meruba. But very often you'll have the back of the ma'avarta, that it's called ma'avarta, miloshen ma'avar. It's like a tunnel. It's a passageway for the ritzua to run through. It's very often the back of the ma'avarta will be rounded or will be some awkward kind of a shape. And people get very nervous about that. But there's nothing to be nervous about because there's no din ribua on the ma'avarta. The ma'avarta could be any shape at all. It could be round. It really doesn't make a difference.
So any part of the rear of the tefillin, whether it's the top right corner, top left corner, bottom right corner, bottom left corner,
it's totally fine. It's totally fine. Even if it's bashed in with a hammer three times, it would be totally, totally fine. Another thing that makes people very nervous very often is that the batim are not black. So does that have to be dealt with? The answer is that me'ikar hadin, batim actually do not have to be black. Most Rishayin and most Paiskim hold that batim could be any color, technically. We make it black because the Rambam says that black is noy, and it's nice for tefillin to be black. So in the middle of the minig has been, as far as I know, the minig has always been to have black tefillin. But me'ikar hadin, most Paiskim hold that there's no din shachrus on the batim. So therefore, if somebody finds that his batim are peeling, the paint is peeling, or the paint is worn away, and there's white spots on the batim, me'ikar hadin, according to most poskim, it's not ma'akiv. Mishnah Berurah does bring, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, a chidah and a Vilna Gaon that they disagree. So certainly somebody should try to ensure that his batim are black, to be mekayim those shitas. But if a person sees that his batim are not black, he doesn't have to, you know, make himself crazy to paint it immediately. Now, they do sell those little paint things, and a person should make use of them. Just remember, before applying the paint, say, L'shem Kedushas Tefillin. If a person doesn't say L'shem Kedushas Tefillin, he could be getting into some shilas. So a person should always say, before applying the paint, L'shem Kedushas Tefillin. Yes?
What about markers?
Markers are fine. Yeah, I'm saying that there are different companies that make the markers and the little, you know, white-out blackout things. There are ones that have hashgacha from the Badatz Eid HaFeredis. Those are the best ones to use. I'm not saying the other hashgachas are not reliable, but the Badatz hashgacha is certainly reliable, and somebody could and should make use of either the marker or the little brush. I personally like the little brush because it usually lasts longer than the markers, but the markers are fine too. Yeah.
Those are special ink, and you can't just use a stone black sharpie.
That's a very good question. It is special ink because it's made for the batim and the ritzuas. The batim machers use a special type of a dye. But yes, me'ikar adin, anything that doesn't have a dover tame in it, meaning crushed bugs or something like that, that are not kosher, anything that doesn't have a dover tame in it would be usable. So if someone would call Sharpie and find out that it's all synthetic ingredients or whatever it may be, technically, halachically, that would be okay. Again, commonly we use the traditional paint that are used by the batimachers, but me'ikar din, that would technically, theoretically, that would be fine. When it comes to ritzuas, on the other hand, ritzuas have to be black. In other words, batim, we just said, most poskim hold, do not have to be black. Ritzuas, on the other hand, have to be black. The question becomes, what's the parameters of black relative to ritzuas? The Mishnah Berurah entertains the possibility in the Bir Halacha and Siman Lamed Gimel that if one has a white dot somewhere in his ritzua, the entire ritzua would be pasul, and he's not mekayim mitzvah tefillin, and the bracha is a bracha levatala. He doesn't say that that's the halacha, he leaves it as a tzarachian, but he entertains such a possibility. What's the Stodim to say that that would not be the halacha? The stodim to say that that would not be the halacha are, number one, perhaps we could say rubai kekulei. Most of the ritzua is black, so halachically the entire ritzua has a din of being black. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the ritzua has to be a certain shear. Okay, it has to have a certain length. The length, let's say, of the shalyad that one needs, technically, is enough to put on the tefillin, wrap it around his upper arm once, stretch it down to his finger, tie it three times around his finger, and that's it. Meikra Adin, that's all one needs in the Ritzua. Now, generally, in the Ritzua Shalyad, what part gets worn away? It's the end. The part that, after someone's finished putting on all of his tefillin, and he wraps it in, he sticks it in his fingers, in his palm, so that's usually the part that gets worn out and loses the shachris. So, many Paiskim say, that part is past the shear. It's way past the shear. The Ritzuas are much, much longer than the minimum shear. So, anything beyond the shear in the length wouldn't be problematic. That's another possibility to say that a fading ritzua wouldn't be a problem. Recognize as well that this applies in the width of the ritzua too. In other words, here you have a ritzua. This ritzua is 15 millimeters wide. How wide does it have to be al pi halacha? Al pi halacha, it has to be approximately 10 millimeters wide, a centimeter. So it's 50% wider than it needs to be. What part of the ritzua usually gets worn out? It's usually the edges. So if someone has, let's say on this side, the edge is worn out and it's not black anymore, he has the shear from this side to this side. So they say that also could possibly salvage the ritzua. So most achrayim that talk about the shayla are actually makel with either one of these two kulas. But again, because the Mishnah Berurah is not so sure about it, l'chatchila, a person should try and ensure that his ritzuas are black everywhere. And again, here the markers and the brushes come in very handy. A person can take a look at his ritzua once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month. Just make sure that they're black. And then, if need be, you say l'shem kedushas tefillin, you paint it, and your problem is solved. But again, it's important for someone who's going to be a Rav to know that if someone comes over to you and asks you, are my tefillin kosher? There's no need to create panic. There are kulas to rely on. And the ideal thing to do would be to tell the person, until now everything has been fine, l'chatchila, paint it now, and you'll be even better off in the future.
Could you address black
took the words right out of my mouth. Because of this issue with the black ritzuas, so a new invention was created. We live in a generation where people don't like to have too much trouble and to be bothered with halachic issues. So they said, you know what? I have a great idea. I'll take the ritzua, I'll dunk it in a vat of black paint, and the black will seep through the entire ritzua. In other words, for the last 3,000 years, the way ritzuas were made was you had a hide of an animal, which is white or gray or whatever color it was, and then they would just paint the top part of the ritzua. And that's what you saw. So you had black on one side, you had, we'll call it white or gray on the other side. That's the way ritzuas were made for 3,000 years. About 20, 30 years ago, they came up with an idea. Why do we have to waste our time painting our ritzuas if we just soak the ritzua in black dye, so then the black will penetrate the leather through and through? And in that way, it's like a chocolate cake. If somebody has a chocolate cake and you cut the cake, so it's not white on the inside, it's black on the inside, right? So the ritzua will be like a chocolate cake. So even if the top gets worn out, wherever it may be, it's always still going to remain black. And like this, you solve the whole problem. You have kosher ritzuas. As long as they don't rip, you could be set for life. Yeah?
It's preferable to not have that.
So, some paiskim were very enthusiastic about this idea. They thought that it's taka great. It solves the problem. You don't have the suffix of the Mishnah Berurah. And for that reason, you do find many chashuvei rabbanim that wear these ritzuas. Rav Aaron Leib Shteinman wore these ritzuas. There are many other chashuvei rabbanim that like these ritzuas and use the ritzuas and wear the ritzuas. Other rabbanim were much more hesitant to endorse such an idea. The primary reason for what's called in Hebrew the histagut, the
Resistance,
thank you. The resistance to this idea was primarily just because it's a break from tradition. Klal Yisrael has been doing this for 3,000 years one way. It just doesn't seem right to suddenly switch it because we're lazy. Rav Vosner writes in a tshuva that even though technically, halachically, he can't come up with any reason why it should be a problem, but he said, it's such a simple idea, And it's something that they could have thought of for thousands of years, and nobody ever thought to do such a thing. Al karchach, there must be a reason why nobody ever did such a thing. And whatever that reason is, even if we can't figure it out, but we should be chayshish for that reason, and we shouldn't use such ritzuos. Rav Ozner, he didn't really like it. He wrote, if a yachid wants to do it, he said, I can't stop him, maybe even tavli alot bracha. But for the tzibur, he felt it wasn't a good idea. Rav Eliashiv also didn't like it. Of course, also he felt it's a break from the Maseirah, and he was not happy with this idea at all. He didn't use them, Rav Ozner didn't use them, and that was their position. Rav Chaim Kanievsky, he had an interesting take on it. He had a Gemara in Mayakotin where, I think if I'm not mistaken, it's on Daf Chav Dalet, and there's a Rashi over there. And from that Rashi, it's Mefurish, Mavur, whatever lashon you prefer to use, that the back of the Ritzua is not black. Because Rashi describes the Ritzua over there, and Rashi describes the face of the Ritzua, which is black, and it's clear over there that the back of the Ritzua is not black. So Chaim Kanievsky felt that if somebody's going to use these all-black Ritzuas, so that would be against Shitas Rashi, and Rashi's explaining the Gemara, so it's against the Gemara, and therefore such Ritzuas should not be used. Lamaisa today, it would seem to me, that most people ordering tefillin do order the black Ritzuas. It seems to have taken over society. And again, Reb Eliashiv and Reb Ozner, they didn't hold that it was also to use, and there are other paiskim, like we said, that hold that it's a good thing to use. So we leave it as an open issue. If somebody wants to get them, he can get them. If somebody wants to stick with the traditional ritzuas, so that would be fine as well. As a rav, as future rabbanim, it's kedai to learn how to adjust the knots. Very often, the Gemara even says it, but very often a person will need his shel reish adjusted. A rav will see somebody in shul whose shel reish is halfway down his forehead. Mishnah Berurah says that if even part of the shel reish is on the forehead, the person is not yetzer of the mitzvah. And therefore, it's kedai for a rav to be able to know how to adjust the knots, to be able to help people so that they won't get stuck in a situation where they're wearing tefillin in a way that they're not mekayim the mitzvah.
Could you address where exactly on the back should the knot be?
It's a very, very unclear question. I'll address it without providing any clarity.
Wonderful.
I did write a sefer about this topic, and in the sefer, so I included an illustration of where the knot should be on the back, and in the illustration that I printed over there, the knot is on the bone, right? If everyone feels their skull in the back, you'll feel that the skull comes to an end, and then there's a cavity under that area. So the clear mashmaus of the paiskim is that it should be at the edge of that bone. So there's a big lack of clarity. What does that mean? Does that mean that it should be on the bone, or it shouldn't be on the bone? Should it be in what's called the guma, in the cavity? Or should it be on the etzem? Should it be on the bone? So I saw a cute tshuva from Chaim Kanievsky. Somebody sent him the shaila. They asked him, "Im adif sheha kesher yeh b'soifa etzem o b'toich haguma?" So Reb Chaim wrote back, "Chetzi chetzi." That's what Reb Chaim said. So again, in the illustration that I printed, it's on the edge of the bone. It's on the bone. I got a phone call from Chassidish fellow in Montreal, and he was very, very displeased with that, and he let me have it in rapid fire Yiddish, and he said that he has a list of 72 paiskim and mekubalim that say mefurish that it should be in the guma. I was a little taken by surprise. 72? Okay, I don't know. I started looking around. I couldn't find any. So I don't know who and where he got his 72 paiskim in the kubalim from, but I couldn't find a single paisik that says lahedya that it should be in the guma. But if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, it's very, very unclear whether it means the guma or whether it means the bone. And maybe Reb Chaim's idea is taka the best, that it should be partially in the guma and partially in the guma and partially on the bone. Lamaisa, in terms of how low it can go, So it can go to the bottom of the hairline in the back. So that, generally, a person has plenty of space. Now, as far as somebody who doesn't have his hairline anymore, he used to, but no longer has it. So we go by where the hairline was. Wherever the hairline was, that's where the tefillin are meant to be.
The knot in the back could go as far as low.
So the knot in the back could go as low as the bottom of the hair.
So if you have to air on the cord, if you have to air to the side of the cord, you could pull it lower.
For sure, better. Better lower. In general, it's generally better lower in the back because it provides more traction. Usually, if it's in the guma, or mostly in the guma, or partially in the guma, it stays more fitted to the head. Whereas if it's on the bone, very often it'll slide around, especially if a person has a lot of hair. Yeah.
The shower can go in front of the hairline. How far back could that actually?
Could go pretty far back. It could go up to what's called in the lashon of Chazal ad shemokem shereisha shel tinek reifes, which means until the, it's like also a sort of cavity in the center of the head. It's pretty far back. I mean, you could fit two pairs of tefillin there, right? Because the Gemara says that a person can fit two roshim on his head at the same time. So you have, it's definitely on the shel resh as well in the front. It's better to err on the side of caution and have it too far back, as it were, than too far down. Because if a person has it too far down, like we said before, even a mashahu, Mishnah Berurah says he's not yotzei the mitzvah. Those are some of the more common issues that come up when it comes to batin. When it comes to Sifrei Torah, so what does a Rav have to know when it comes to Sifrei Torah? So when it comes to Sifrei Torah, primarily the main thing a Rav has to know is that the Sifrei Torah is kosher. How is he meant to know that the Sifrei Torah is kosher? So that it's been purchased from a reliable person, number one. It's been checked by at least two magiim, two manual human people who check the Sefer Torah beginning to end, and something that they've had for the last 30, 40 years already is called a computer check. And what the computer checks for is spelling mistakes. So if the Sefer Torah has gone through a computer, technically all the spelling mistakes should have been caught. Experience has shown that it doesn't always cover it exactly for a whole variety of reasons that we can't get into right now. But by doing a second computer check at the end of the process, when the Sefer Torah is complete, so to speak, put it through a computer check again, that often will save a lot of problems, and it's very kedai. So if someone's going to be a Rav and he has the ability, it won't cause a fight with the whole kehila, it would be kedai to ensure, like we said, number one, that it was purchased from a reliable person, which it's hard to know what a reliable person is, but there are a svarim out there that maybe could help guide people to how to find the reliable people. And number two, that it was checked twice by manual checkers. And number three, that it went through two computer checks. Now, we know when it comes to mezuzahs, so mezuzahs have to be checked twice in 7 years. So how often does a Sefer Torah have to be checked? So there's no halacha. It doesn't say anywhere in Shulchan Aruch how often a Sefer Torah should be checked. But it would seem logic would dictate that it would be kedai to have a Sefer Torah checked once every 15, 20 years or so, which I think almost nobody is really makbid on. But the fact of the matter is that if you walk into all these old shuls that are closing down and you look at all the Sefer Torah that are 60, 70, 80 years old, you'll find that pretty much all of them, the letters are no longer black. If the letters are no longer black, the Sefer Torah are no longer kosher. Because at some point over time, the ink oxidizes and the blackness disappears and it turns either a transparent type of gray or a rust color. A rust color is a machlekes between the Prima Gadim and the Chassam Sefer, whether that would still be kosher or not. So therefore, Sefer Torah should be checked to ensure that they're still kosher and that they're still black. A general thing to keep in mind, well, not to keep in mind, but something to be aware of, is that there's a, and here this, I don't think this qualifies as any self-promotion over here, because I have nothing to gain from this. Since I have nothing to gain, I think it's okay for me to talk about it. There is a new thing that never existed before, as far as I know of, in the history of Stam, and that's what's called a hashgacha, or we don't like to use the word hashgacha, instead we'll use the word pikuach. Pikuach means supervision. Supervision of Stam. Nobody would walk into a grocery store and buy a box of Honey Nut Cheerios if it didn't have hashgacha on it. We've all been trained in from our youth that you don't buy food if it doesn't have hashgacha on it. 100 years ago, wasn't like that. 100 years ago, you looked at the ingredients. If it didn't say lard in the ingredients, pretty much it was fine and everybody ate it. Along came the OU and other kashrus organizations, and they introduced the idea of kashrus on food. And kashrus, the idea of the kashrus is that the entire process is supervised, and there's a hashgacha. So somebody knows that this is food that can be eaten. What's that bottle called? The air up? Just heard that shiur yesterday. Right? So even air up bottles need hashgacha, according to some people, right? So Stam, it's a little funny that there's never been hashgacha on Stam before. One would think that something as important as the tefillin that you're wearing every day and the mezuzahs that are on your door every day would have hashgacha, but such a thing never existed. There is a new organization that I'm fortunate enough to be part of. It's called STAMP, which stands for Stam Project. And STAMP, which started germinating in people's minds around 4 years ago, has actually come to fruition over the course of the last year. And there are mezuzahs. It started with mezuzahs, tefillin, parshiyos as well, although not yet batim and ritzuas. So there's still a ways to go. And until it gets into the tzibur at large, there's also still a ways to go. But it does exist. There are mezuzahs out there that are being sold with stamp certification. It comes with a label. And the OU has joined forces with Stamp, and the OU is also actively in the process of joining and promoting the idea of this certification for Stam. My wife just sent me this morning a link to an article and a picture of the Satmar Rebbe. I'm not sure which one. Looking at a computer, which is the Stamp program. Stamp has created a new computer check, which is much, much better than the previous computer checks that existed. Now, one thing to point out about the computer check is that a computer check doesn't substitute for a human. Even in the Stamp computer program, it's not meant to substitute a human check. All Stam needs to be checked. Tefillin and mezuzahs should be checked at least once, ideally twice, by a human being, as well as by a computer. Sefer Torah has to be checked at least twice by a human being as well. So there's a hashgacha called Hisachdus HaRabbanim, which is a Chassidus hashgacha. I think it's primarily run by Satmar, but it's other Chassidim as well. And Hisachdus HaRabbanim also, is this being recorded? I hope not. I think they're also, it is, okay. So they are also joining forces with the OU. So you have YU and Satmar together to try and ensure that the Stam that gets out there is kosher. Rabbi Elephant from the OU, there's a picture of him sitting together with the Satmar Rav, and what they're discussing is the Stamp certification. So as people are going to be future Rabbanim Bezras Hashem, one should be aware that it's kedai. Again, at the moment, I wouldn't say it's widespread. It's far from it. But Bezras Hashem, it'll become widespread. And it's kedai to encourage people to use Stam that has a proper hashgacha if such a thing is available.
How does that differ from the Bad Mishmer Stam?
It differs radically from the Bad Mishmer Stam. The Bad Mishmer Stam is a wonderful, wonderful organization. The Bad Mishmer Stam was founded in the late 1970s by two Yidden. One's name is Rav David Leib Greenfield, They're both still alive. The other one's name is, I forget. And they joined forces and they created the Vad Mishmer Stam. The Vad Mishmer Stam was under the direction, the direct direction of Rav Vosner, the Shevet Halevi, and they made a mapecha in the world of Stam. They introduced the idea of certification, Sefer getting certified, which means that a Sefer, just like if somebody wants to sell insurance, he has to be certified, he has to pass tests. So too, Lahavdil, somebody wants to write a mezuzah, there's no reason why anybody, the Lashon of the Keses HaSefer is Kol Reku Poiches, which basically means any bum can pick up a kolmus and just write a mezuzah. It's not the way it should be. And if somebody wants to write a mezuzah, he should be properly certified. So they created a curriculum of what a Sefer has to learn, what a Sefer has to know, and the Vad Mishmer HaStam introduced what's called a Te'udah, certification, a license, for Sefer. Vad Mishmer HaStam also created at the time, talking in the early 80s, Shiurim on Hilchos HaStam, all across America and Eretz Yisrael, for Seferim to be able to go to Shiurim and become knowledgeable. And the Vad Mishmer HaStam created the initial computer check. So the Vad Mishmer HaStam did and does amazing work. Yeah?
As a consumer, how much diligence do we need to do? Like, can we just walk into today and store, buy mezuzahs and
So that brings us back to what I was talking about a minute ago, is that very often, unfortunately, the people in the Judaica stores who are selling the tefillin, sometimes when a person walks into a Judaica store, the person selling the tefillin and mezuzahs is a sefer, and he's knowledgeable about sefers, and he's reliable, and if that's the case, then that's great. But very often, it's a Judaica store. They sell talesim, they sell, you know, kiddush cups, and mezuzahs. But if you ask the guy a few questions about the mezuzah, he's not going to know any answers because he's not a sefer, he doesn't know anything about sefers. So such a store one should definitely not buy tefillin and mezuzahs from or in. One should try and stick to reliable people. Now, what's a reliable person? So that a person should do his due diligence, because like we said, it's something, a mezuzah is something you're using every minute of every day of your life, and tefillin you're using the vast majority of the days of your life, so a person should put in at least double or triple the amount of homework that he would put into buying a new car. He should put in at least that amount into trying to find out where he can get the best tefillin and mezuzahs. But coming back to your question, so the Vad Mishmer HaStam, that's what they did, and that's what they do. It's now under new direction. There's a younger generation of people that took over the Mishmer HaStam, and like we said, they do wonderful work. But the Vad Mishmer HaStam is not a hashgacha. They don't offer any supervision. They're not taking any achrayas on anything. In other words, if you're going into a store or you're going to a sefer and you're buying a mezuzah, so you can ask, does the sefer have a tu'udah? Is he certified? And the answer will be, let's say the answer is yes. Okay, so that's fantastic. It's 1,000 times better than if he doesn't have a tu'udah, but it doesn't mean that the mezuzah is kosher. You still have no way of knowing if the mezuzah is kosher or not. What Stamp is doing is actually providing certification that this mezuzah, in other words, Stamp, on the label of every mezuzah, there's a QR code. You can scan in the QR code, and the QR code will tell you who wrote the mezuzah, what type of ink it was written with. There are different types of inks that Seifrim use. What type of cloth it was written on, when it was written, which is very important, especially for Parshias. Of course, four parshas have to be written in order. So let's say someone's Shel Rosh, one parsha becomes pasul, and he wants to be mashlamit with other parshas from somebody else, so you have to know the dates when it was written. So in the stamp QR code, you'll find when the item was written, who the two magiim who checked it are, and again, all the seifrim, any mezuzah or tefillin written with a stamp certification was written by a sefer who's passed the tests, either by the Mishmer HaStam or by Stamp. Stamp also provides certification and testing. And the Magiim also are certified. Notice very often, if you walk into a Judaica store, even if you buy a mezuzah that was written by a sefer who has certification, that doesn't mean that it was checked by anybody at all. And even if it was checked by somebody, it doesn't mean that it was checked by somebody who has certification himself. There's different certifications, there's different licenses, degrees for seifrim and magiim. A seifer basically I would phrase it this way. A Sofer is like a bachelor's and a Megiyah is like a master's. Because the Sofer just has to know what to write and how to write it. But a Sofer won't necessarily know what to look for in terms of finding Psulim or what the Halacha is if there's a Shaila on the Mezuzah. A Megiyah is trained to a much higher level of Halachic intricacies regarding each and every letter, what presents a Shaila, what doesn't present a Shaila. I got emails. Sometimes a half a dozen a day, from all over, from different people with pictures of tefillin and mezuzahs, asking, "Is this letter kosher? Is this hey?" Just on the way here, I got a couple of emails. "Is this hey kosher? Is this vav kosher?" Last night, there's a Beis Hayro in Beit Vegan, where I am every Wednesday night, and last night I was there, and for an hour straight, people are coming in with tefillin, mezuzahs, sifrei Torah, all kinds of shailas regarding letters. Are these letters kosher? Are these letters not kosher? So again, a sofer doesn't have to know any of those halachas. A sofer just has to know what to do. So like I'm saying again, even if somebody buys a mezuzah in a Judaica store written by a sofer with certification, it doesn't mean that it was checked by anybody who has certification. Ideally, the proper way that things should be done is that a mezuzah should be written by somebody certified, checked by somebody certified, and sold by somebody certified. If the person selling the mezuzah doesn't know anything, he'll never be able to return an item. In other words, if you're selling, if you're on an electronics store, and you see that a particular brand of microwave is junk, and all the people who are buying it are complaining about it, it's not working properly, so you're going to demand... Either you're going to stop selling it, or you're going to go back to the company and say, listen, if you don't shape up, I'm not going to use this anymore. If the person selling the mezuzahs knows Hilchastam, so when he looks at the product, he can say, who wrote this thing? Who checked this thing? This is no good. In other words, in stamp, one of the great things about stamp, and again, I don't mind promoting it because I have nothing, no personal gain from it, if anything, maybe the opposite. The good thing about it is that the Magiyim, who check the tefillin and the mezuzahs, constantly provide feedback to the Seferim. In the world out there, when a Sefer writes something, so he could write, tell you a story that happened with me probably close to 20 years ago. An older Sefer, he brought me a pair of tefillin parashiyos to check. I checked the parashiyos and I told him that the hays are b'di'evit. He was highly insulted, and who are you to tell me that the hays are no good? I've been writing for years, nobody ever told me such a thing. I said, what do you want me to tell you? You gave me a pair of parashiyos to check, I checked them, I'm telling you the hays are b'di'evit. You're not happy with that, I can't help you. A week later, I was sitting in a Beis Hayro in Yerushalayim by Rav Moshe Friedlander. Rav Moshe Friedlander was considered the greatest expert in Stam in the world. And Baruch Hashem, I was able to have many years of sitting by him and observing him, learning from him. So there I was, it was a Tuesday night in the Beis Hayro, and who walks in? This Sefer. So it was very embarrassing for him that I was sitting there, but it was too late, he was there already. He took out the parashiyos, and he showed the hay to Rabbi Friedlander. He said, what's the halacha on this hay? So Rabbi Friedlander told him, by the way, kudos to the Sefer. He could have just ignored me and not done anything about it. But he was an erlich person, and even though he was insulted, hurt, and he thought I was crazy, but l'maisa, he went through the trouble of going to Yerushalayim, going to Rabbi Friedlander, and to show him the hay. Showed him the hay. Rabbi Friedlander told him, it's b'di'evit. So he said to Rabbi Friedlander, I don't understand, I've been writing for 20 years. Nobody ever told me that such a hay was... He's been writing these hays for 20 years. Put out hundreds of pairs of parashiyos. Said, nobody ever told me, no magia ever told me that these hays are problematic. So Rabbi Friedlander told him, so you need to get a new magia. Or what do you want me to tell you? So again, that's another mila of stamps. In stamps system, the magiyim constantly provide feedback to the seferim. In other words, instead of checking a pair of parashiyos like that, finding the hay and doing nothing about it, they won't let it through. It won't get certified. It'll go back to the cipher. They'll explain to the cipher that the hay's are not written properly, and he'll be able to correct it from that day on. On top of that, there's another layer quality control that one of the Rabbanim of Stamp, there are four Rabbanim involved in Stamp, one of the Rabbanim comes into the office every single day and spot checks the work of the Magiyim. So the Magiyim are checking the work of the Seferim and providing the Seferim with feedback, and the Rabbanim are spot checking the Magiyim and providing them with feedback. And as I said, there's four different Rabbanim that come in every day, so they're getting the full gamut of opinions and ideas of what the best way that something should be written is, in a way that it could be kosher according to everybody. Yeah?
So anyone who wants to get certified by Stamp has to send their parshas into the main office?
Yes. A Sefer can get certified by Stamp and then not get the Stamp certification on his product. He could just write and sell, and he'll be no different than a Mishmeres Stam Sefer. But he has the option to send it into the Stamp office, have it checked by the Stamp Magiyim, and then the product will get a label with a QR code and it'll be certified.
How much does that add to the cost of the given item?
At the moment, it doesn't add anything because till today, it's been entirely subsidized by very special people who care deeply about the kashrus of Stam in the world.
Wow.
And at the moment, it doesn't add anything to the price. Hopefully, it'll be able to stay that way in the future. So that's a question that time will tell. But again, at the moment, it doesn't add anything to the cost. It's 102. We should switch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thursday.